Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Tzadi Gimel Amud Aleph by the Mishnah. This Mishnah is known to be a very difficult Mishnah. You can just see that by the comments of Tosafot in the Gemara. He says in the Tosafot, Divrei Matkil, Da Amar La, Midinu Dvarim, Hu Dislike, Lo Yitparesh Shapir Taima, Da Hamilto. Tosafot over here says, I really don't know the reason, I can't really explain what's happening over here. And then in the next Tosfot, he says, Lo yada Rabbi, my kamashmalan matnitin. I don't understand what our Mishnah is coming to teach us. He has a number of other comments of a similar vein that he doesn't understand or he can't explain what's going on in the Mishnah. The Rif also, in his introduction to dealing with this sugya, says that this is an extremely difficult sugya that in many ways defies explanation. And truthfully, for over 1,000 years, this Mishnah was a very difficult Mishnah, almost impossible to decipher the logic in the Mishnah. Before we get to the Mishnah itself, I want to give a small introduction which will help us, because once we have the information in hand, then we can explain the Mishnah and the Gemara in an easier fashion than simply reading through it and then trying to decipher it on the spot. Obviously indebted to Professor Uman, who spent a lot of time on this Mishnah. It's a beautiful story. He is a Nobel Prize winner in game theory. And as he himself notes, that the Mishnah does not require game theory in order to solve the Mishnah. It just happens to be that because of the tools of game theory, they were able to find the logic in the Mishnah. And then through that, they backed into the reason as to why the Mishnah does it and found a more simple explanation for the Mishnah, which actually was illuminating in terms of the thesis and the theory that they used in solving the Mishnah. He also mentioned that he had a partner in doing this, that it was him and a Professor Michal Meshler, who was also his partner in solving this problem. And he also mentioned that his son, Hashem Yikom Domo, was killed in the Lebanese War in 1982, was learning at the Mir at the time, was the one who pointed him to this Mishnah when he was reading about a math theorem, and told him that he should take a look at this Mishnah in that context. So now, independent of this Mishnah on the Gemara, if we come into a situation in which you have multiple claimants, and then you have limited assets to deal with the claims of the individuals, if you are faced with that situation, there are a number of ways to solve the problem, or how to subdivide the property between the claimants that are there. To us, the most simple and logical way to do it would be to do it pro rata. That based on the pro rata claims of the individuals, we would take the pot and we would subdivide the pot based on their pro rata claims. So in our instance, we're going to see in the Mishnah that there is a claim for 100, there's a claim for 200, and it's a claim for 300. And then there are different pools of money left in the estate, and you want to subdivide that. So for instance, in a case where you had 100 left in the pool, if you were to divide it pro rata based on their claims, you would have the 100 would get 16 and two-thirds, the 200 would get 33 and a third, and the 300 would get 50. And that's pro rata to their claims. Basically, you would add their claims together, the 100, 200, 300, 600. You divide it into six parts, and then the 100 gets one part, the 200 gets two parts, and the 300 gets three parts, or whatever it is that you divide it into sixths. So that would be the simplest way if we looked at the Mishnah or we looked at a situation like this. That's how we would divide it, is on a pro rata basis. Another methodology, which will come up later in the sugya, is what we call the even methodology, which is that everybody gets the same amount. We all have a fair claim here on the estate, and therefore we're all entitled to the same amount in the division until you clear your claim. So in that instance where you have 100 in the pot, each individual will get 33 and a third. And the same would be true at 200. Everybody would get 66 and two-thirds. And you would continue on until the 100 claim was filled. And then the residual would then be split evenly between the parties. So that's another method of dividing up the estate in a logical manner, in a fair manner. Now, each one of these different methodologies is logical, is fair, and a question of which one you use or which method is in use. Like we said before, today to us, the most logical or the most obvious would be that of a pro rata method. But here we just showed another methodology which is equally logical and very plausibly fair. And it comes out with different answers because it uses a different algorithm in order to determine the payouts to each of the individuals. There are two more methodologies of payout which become very relevant over here. The next one is what we call the payout of what's called Shibuda. It's promoted by the Ravid over here, and we'll see later on becomes very relevant in the Gemara, which is that the division is based on your Shibud, your lien on the property. So here you have 100, 200, and 300 claim, and then you have assets in the estate. When you get to make your claim, you get to divide within the estate up to the level of your claim. So in a case where there's 100 in the estate, then every one of them has an even claim on that 100, and they would get 33 and a third each in that instance. Once we get to 200, the claimant for the 100 has a right to split in the first 100. But after that first 100, they're out of the picture, and then the remaining parties get to split it evenly. So in that instance where there's 200, the first party, the 100 claimant, would get 33 and a third, and the 200 and 300 claimant would each get 83 and a third. They have the 33 and a third from the first 100, plus in the second 100, they would divide it evenly, 50-50. So they get 83 and a third for the 200 claimant, the 300 claimant, and the first claimant would get 33 and a third. Again, and that continues through. You can keep doing that same methodology. That's another method of division. Yeah, if you get up to 300, then again, you would have the first one getting 33 and a third, the second one getting 83 and a third, and then the fourth one getting 183 and a third, because they divide up the first 100 evenly, because everyone has a claim on the first 100. So that's a 33 and a third for each one of the parties. Then,
because the second
over his claim level, so then he doesn't divide in that second 100 according to this, and then the third gets the 300 by himself, because there's nobody has a claim that high. That's another methodology for division, which is, again, promoted by the Ravid. The last one, and which becomes the key element of explaining this Mishnah, is a methodology that is mentioned, the Rif quotes it in the name of Haigon. He makes a cryptic reference to the fact that our Mishnah follows the Mishnah in Baba Metzia. And then through Professor Oman's work, he basically shows it's not obvious what the Rif means, but once you understand the thesis and what they solved over here, you can go back and understand that the Rav Haigon had a brilliant insight into this Mishnah, and he is the key to the explanation of this Mishnah. And that is based on the Mishnah that everybody knows in Baba Metzia, which is Shnai Mochzim. You have two people that grab onto a talit. One of them says, Kula Shali. One of them says, Kula Shali. Each one of them says, the whole thing belongs to me. Then Chokim, we split it. They each get 50%. The next case is the key case, and this is what helps us all. First one says, Kula Shali, they grabbed it. The second one says, Chetzia Shali, half of it is mine. So you have one claimant claiming the whole talit for himself. You have the other claimant claiming 50% for himself. In that instance, the Mishnah says that the division is, the one who claimed 50% gets a quarter. The one who claimed 100% gets three quarters. Why? What is the methodology of division over there? Rashi explains it over there, and this methodology is used in other places. We actually bumped into it in Yevamot. In Yevamot, when it came to the division of property for a safek, a ben safek, that was Shiva to the Yavam, and Teisha to the original husband. In that case, there was a safek, and they have to divide up the properties. This same methodology was used, and we did the math at the time in the Gemara in Yevamot. The methodology uses the split between the two parties depends on the contested amount. Any part that you acquiesce belongs to the other party is not within the pool of contested amounts, and that automatically goes to the other party. So in the case of the talit, the one who says that I own half of it, he agrees that the second 50% definitely belongs to the other party. That's not in the contested amount. That means before we start, the one who says it's all mine, 50% of it belongs to him, without any question between them. What's left after that is the other 50%. Over that 50%, they're both arguing. And that contested amount, we split it evenly. So the 50% that's being contested, half of it will go to the person who says, I own a half of it. That means a quarter will belong to him. The other party gets a quarter, which is the one who says it's all mine, plus the 50% that the other man agreed to or gave to him. So that division comes out to be 75% and 25%. Again, another methodology that is both fair and logical. And if you go through all the methodologies that we just used, and then we're going to read the Mishnah in a second, you'll see that each one of the pieces of the Mishnah seems to fit one of these methodologies. None of them can produce the answer that gives you all three stages in the Mishnah, except for that last methodology. The last methodology, which is the methodology used by the Mishnah in Baba Metzia, that is the only methodology that actually solves our Mishnah. And it turns out that for these setups, the only answer, there's only one answer that would qualify to match that methodology, and those are the answers that are given in our Mishnah. So what plagued both the Gemara and the Rishonim for many years is that they're taking the other methodologies, what we noted, and they're trying to apply them to our Mishnah, and they're not able to get to the same results as the Mishnah. Even though, as simple as it sounds, to apply the Mishnah above Metzia to here is much more complex, because here you have multivariables, which is that in each of the cases, you have three women, and you have to match up each series of women. That means that in each series, you have three different matchups that you have to figure out. It's one woman one with woman two, woman one with woman three, woman two with woman three, and you have to then match that up, so it gives you those pairs will give you the methodology in each case. So there's a total of nine pairs in the Mishnah that you have to figure out. And it's the methodology or the algorithm to do it, and that's what is the brilliance of these professors, is that they figured out how to solve that. How do you do that? It's very easy, you know, from us, from a parent standpoint, where the numbers are whole numbers and you can divide it up. What they showed is that this methodology can be used ad infinitum, and that there is a methodology for doing it, the algorithm for solving it. It's complex. I could explain it now. I'm just not sure there's a lot of value to it. But the methodology uses a methodology which first looks at the claims and up to the 50% point. And once you hit the 50% point, it reverses and starts to look at the losses for the division. And if you use those two pieces, you're able to come to the solution that is brought by our Mishnah. So that's the brilliance or the insight, is to simply apply the Mishnah in Bava Metzia to here. And that's why they believe that that's the solution to this Mishnah, because that's something that's not beyond the grasp of the Gemara. The game theory that they used to solve the problem in the Mishnah was beyond the grasp of anybody in Chazal. It wasn't something that was known to Chazal at all, the thesis. But the Gemara Mishnah in Baba Metzia was something that was known to them, and very well could have been applied over here. Okay, now based on that, now we're going to go to the Mishnah, and we'll point out the different Rishonim, the different pieces of the Gemara, to show the methodologies that are used. Right? Me, Shaya Nasui Shalosh Nashim. Someone is married to three women, umet, and then he passes away, leaving all three women with claims on his estate. Tubata Shelzo Maneh. The first woman has a tuba that's worth 100 zuz. The Shelzo Mataim. The second woman has a tuba that's worth 200. The Shelzo Shalosh Meot. And the third woman has a tuba that is worth 300. Now, as Rashi points out, and it's obvious that you have to say this, Shloshtam nechtamu b'yom echad. All the ktubot have the same date on them. If they don't have the same date on them, then it's easy. Whoever has the earliest date has the first lien, and they get paid out in full before any of the other parties. The division here of this Mishnah is only applicable when they come and they all have the same claim date. Because they have the same claim date, now we have to find out a way or figure out a way to subdivide the property between each of the claimants. So they're coming at the same date, and now the matter is, how do we divide up the estate if the estate doesn't contain sufficient assets to pay them out? If the estate had 600 zuz in it, there'd be nothing to discuss. The woman with 100 tuba would get 100, the one with 200 would get 200, and the one with 300 would get her 300 and be done. So in terms of paying them out, if you have sufficient assets, again, there's nothing to discuss. Obviously, the problem here is ve'ein sham ela maneh. There's only 100 zuz in the estate. How do you divide this? Chokim bishaveh. They divide it evenly. Evenly means 33 and a third each. That's what they would get in this instance. Now, to us, that would be logical. That was one of the methodologies that we mentioned before, which is that we divide everything in the estate evenly until you reach the level of your claim being filled. So in this case, you would assume that 33 and a third, 33 and a third, 33 and a third, if you bumped up to 200, then you would assume that each party got 66 and two-thirds. But as soon as the Mishnah moves to the next stage, that's not the answer that it gives. Hayusha Mataim, if there was 200 in the assets of the estate, we would have expected 66 and two-thirds to each of them. That's not the answer. Shomane notelet chamishim. The one who has 100 claim here gets 50. Shomataim v'shel shlosh meot. The 200 and the 300 get shlosha shel zahav. They get 3 gold dinarim. A gold dinar is worth 25 dinare kesef. So 3 times 25 is 75. So each one of them will get 75 each. So the first woman gets 50. The second two women get 75 each. Again, the methodology for that is somewhat elusive. We don't understand how they got to this division. We'll come back to that. Hayusham shlosh meot. If there is 300 in terms of assets in the estate, then shomane notelet chamishim. The 100 gets 50. Veshomataim mane. The 200, the woman with the 200 claim gets 100. Veshlosh meot. And the woman who has the 300 claim gets shisha shel zahav. 6 gold coins, which is the equivalent of 6 times 25, are 150. So in this instance, we have the payouts be 50, 100, and 150. In that case, you basically have a pro rata distribution of their claims. Their claims are for 600. If you look at that, that's 1/6 belongs to the claimant that has 100. 2/6 belongs to the claimant with the 200, and 3/6 belongs to the claimant with the 300. And that's exactly what the division is over here. If you take 300, 1/6 of 300 is 50, 2/6 is 100, 3/6 is 150. That's the division that's used in this last section of the Mishnah. Bechein, the Gemara says, Gimeshli Tilu Lukis, 3 people joined into a partnership to do business together. Pichtu, Ohotiru, if there was diminishment in the value, or there was an increase in the value through the business that they entered together, the partnership they entered together, kach heinokim. This is the same way, that division that we just showed in our Mishnah, that's the same way you would divide in partners who joined in a business together. How do we divide the profits or losses? Based on whatever our Mishnah just showed. So now you understand the difficulty in the Mishnah. We have the first case which seemingly uses a division that is equal. We have the third case, which seemingly uses a division, which is pro rata share based on your claim. And then we have a middle case, which is not clear how the Mishnah divided it. Now, what Professor Oman showed is that if you take the Gemara in Bava Metzia, the Gemara in Bava Metzia says that any uncontested amount automatically goes to that party. Any contested amount, that is subdivided. Based on that, you can explain the entirety of our Mishnah, and then you can apply one logic to all 3 cases. So for in the first instance, where there's only 100 in the estate, all 3 parties are making a claim to that 100. None of them concede any of that to the other party, because each one of them has a full claim on the 100. Therefore, you'll get a subdivision of 33 and a third, 33 and a third, 33 and a third. In the second case, where you have 200, in that case, the woman who is 100, she contests the first 100, but in terms of the second 100 in the estate, it's uncontested from her perspective. Second 100 of the 200 is uncontested. As far as she's concerned, she has no claim on that. She would cede the second 100 to the other 2 parties. So therefore, in terms of her claim here, the only contested amount for her is the first 100. That's the only place where she actually has a claim that would suffice the entirety of her claim. 100, and then the 100 in the assets. The excess 100, she really doesn't have a claim on because she doesn't believe that's a contested amount. That's not an amount that she believes belongs to her. Therefore, she cedes that to the woman with the 200 ketubah and the woman with the 300 ketubah. So in that instance, you would expect that the first woman in this case would get 50 because in her contest with the other 2 women, she is contesting the other 2 women's claim to the 100. So in terms of the division here, 50% of the first 100 will go to her. 50% will go to the other 2 parties. Woman 2 and woman 3 will get the other 50%. So out of the first 100, she will get 50 of the first 100. And the other 2 women will get the other 50 of the 100. In the second 100, then woman number 1 has no claim anymore. Because as far as she's concerned, that's not a contested amount. That's part of the uncontested amount for her. But woman 2 and woman 3 both make full claims on the second 100. One is entitled to 50, and the other one's entitled to 50. They're going to split the second 100. So woman number 2 is going to get 50. And woman number three is going to get 50 because they split the contested amount, which is the next 200. So they'll each get 50. Added together with the 25 that they received from the first 100, that gives each of them 75. So in that instance, the first woman will get 50, and the next two women will get 75 each. You go to the third case, where there's 300 in the pot. So when there's 300 in the pot, the first woman, like in the second case, gets 50, because her contested amount is only the first 100, and there she contests against woman number two and woman number three. As far as 200 and 300, she is uncontested. She doesn't contest that because she doesn't believe she owns it. In the second 100, then woman two and woman three are splitting it evenly because they're both contesting that amount. In the final 100, everybody is ceding that to the third woman. So in ceding that to the third woman, she gets 100 in that last case. So now if I put the pieces together, the first woman would get 50. The second woman would get 100, and the third woman would get 150. So that's the breakdown. Now, it's not as simple as I made it sound, because in the first case, they subdivided the remaining amount. All right, so maybe I should do it better. In the second case, the first woman took 50. The remaining amount that's contested is 150. The remaining contestment is 150. The two women that remain split that evenly, because they're contesting the 150 that remains, 75 to each of them. In the third case, where the first woman gets 50, the second woman and the third woman contest the next 150. So woman number two will get her 25 share from the first case and the 75 from the contested 150 to add up to 100. And the third woman will get the same 100 plus the additional 50, which is uncontested at the end. But you can see here that we subdivided the 50 from the first 100 differently in the second case and the third case. And so therefore, the basic methodology for determining whether something is compliant with the Mishnah and Bobmansiyah is if you add together the payout of the two women, then their payouts will conform to that methodology. So for instance, in the second case of the Mishnah, where woman number one gets 50 and woman number two gets 75, their total payout together is 125. Now, woman number one has a claim of 100, and woman number two has a claim of 200. So out of that 125, 25 of it is not contested by woman number one because it's in excess of her ketubah. So that 25 we would cede to woman number two. The other 100 is in contest between them, and therefore they'd split it 50-50. Therefore, we get the division of 50 to woman number one and 75 to woman number two. In the case where woman number two and number three, in that second case where woman number two and three get 75 each, the total of which is 150. In the 150, that is below the claim of woman number two and woman number three. That means the total amount is being contested between them. And that's why they divide it evenly, 75 and 75. So you can check if any part of the Mishnah conforms to that methodology that is used in Bava Metzia by adding the two women's payouts together, and then determining how much of that payout is contested versus how much of it is uncontested. That's just the methodology for checking that it conforms to that. How do you actually calculate that amount? Knowing the estate and knowing the claims, how do you get to that outcome rather than knowing the outcome and then testing whether the outcome is fair? The basic methodology is that if the estate or the assets of the estate do not exceed half of the total claims, then the basic methodology is you divide all of the assets evenly, but not to exceed half the value of the ketubah. So again, in the first case in the Mishnah, you have 100 in the estate. That is below half the value of all the claims. The claims are 100, 200, and 300, which is a total of 600. Half that claim is 300. So since it's below the 300 number, they're going to split it evenly, which is 33 and a third each. None of those numbers exceed half of their ketubah value. Therefore, there's no cap out. In the second case of the Mishnah, where there is 200 of the estate assets, again, it's below half the amount of the ketubah, which is 300. In that case, they're all going to divide evenly. Well, if they divide the 200 evenly, each one will get 66 and two-thirds. But that exceeds half the value of the claim of the first woman who has a ketubah of 100. So she cannot exceed 50. So we cap her out at 50. The remaining amount of the estate is 150. That is split evenly between woman number two and woman number three. And that's how you get the payouts in the second piece of the Mishnah, which is 50, 75, and 75. In the third part of the Mishnah, which is a case where we have 300 in the estate assets, again, that is not above half the claims that are there. And therefore, in that instance, we will grant them all the amounts evenly. So if you divide 300 evenly, each one would get 100. But for woman number one, that already exceeds half of her ketubah, so she'll be capped out at 50. If we cap her out at 50, that means the remaining assets are 250. If we split those evenly between woman number two and woman number three, they would each get 125. But then woman number two would have an excess of half of her ketubah, and therefore she would only get 100. She's capped out at 100. That means that woman number one is getting 50, woman number two is getting 100, woman number three is getting the residual, which is 150, and that describes the payouts here. Once you exceed the 300 amount, the calculation actually changes, and instead of it being based on their claims, it goes on then to be based on their losses. And therefore, we would subdivide the losses evenly, but not to exceed 50% of your ketubah. So in the case where it's 400, now the 400 is in excess of half the value of the ketubot. Therefore, we focus on the subdividing the losses and not the amount of the estate. So if we take the losses at 400, 600 is the total claims of the ketubot. That means we have losses of 200. The losses of 200, if we subdivide those evenly between all the parties, that's 66 and 2/3 for each of the parties. But in this case, 66 and 2/3 exceeds half of the ketubah of woman number one. And therefore, she'll be capped out at a 50 loss, and she'll receive 50. Now, in terms of the residual, now we have 150 losses that we have to subdivide now between the woman number one now took a loss of 50. There's 150 losses left of the total 200. We will have to split those between woman number two and woman number three. For woman number two, she'll get 75 of loss. Woman number three will get a 75 loss. So if we do that, out of the 200, if she loses 75, woman number two will receive 125. Woman number three, if she takes 75 of losses, she is entitled to 300 minus 75 is 225. And therefore, the 400 will be divided between the women as follows. 50 to woman number one, 125 to woman number two, and 225 to woman number three. So that is the methodology for accomplishing what is set out in the Mishnah and Bava Metzia, which is if the assets that are available to divide are below 50% of the claims, then we subdivide the assets evenly up to a maximum of 50% of your claim. If the assets in the estate exceed 50% of the claims, then we subdivide the losses evenly, but the losses may not exceed 50% of your claim. And so, in the abstract, this methodology of division does two things. One of them is actually related to the game theory, which is that every two women, their interactions with each other are same as the totality of the whole group together. And therefore, if we look at every two women, if the result of their distributions gives us the result that we would have looked for in Bava Metzia, we would expect that both at the individual level of each woman interacting with another woman, as well as on the greater level of the whole pie divided by all the participants that are here, all three women participating. In addition, again, in the abstract, the way to understand the division of the property in this case is that the people with the smaller claims have an advantage for the distribution up to the point of half the amount of the claims. From the second half of the claims onward, the people with the larger claim have the advantage, and we will pay them off faster. So in the first half, meaning assets that reach up to the first half of all the claims that are there, the people with the smaller claims will be advantaged in getting paid up to 50% of their claim faster. For assets in excess of the 50% level, then those people with the larger claims will have repayment faster for that second 50% of their claim than the people with the smaller claims. So it's basically a barbell structure by which the people with the smaller claims will reach the first 50% of their payout quicker, but then will get a much slower repatriation of the second half of their claim. Whereas those people with the larger claim in the first 50% will get that slower. But in the second 50%, they will have an accelerated reclamation of their losses. In that methodology, you get the results that match exactly to our Mishnah, and that would be the algorithm that generates the outcomes of the Gemara and Baba Metzia for multiple women, not just for two parties, but even for three, four, five, six parties that are dividing assets based on their claims. Right? Through that logic, you can explain the Mishnah. And the Mishnah is entirely consistent in the logic that it uses in order to determine the amount that is there. V'chein gimel she'itilu l'kis, three individuals who went into a business venture or partnership together, pichtu ootiru, if there was losses or profits, kachein chokim. In that same manner, they subdivide the profits from the investment. So here, again, they are putting in investments of different amounts, similar to the ketubot, that have different claims on the assets of the estate. So to over here, you have people putting in different principal amounts, who have different levels of claims on the profits or losses that are generated through this business venture or partnership. So the way that we divide up the profits is in the same methodology that our Mishnah gave us over here. And as Tosfos points out, it's not clear here when the Mishnah says, V'chein shlosha she'itilu l'kis, which one of the reference points in the Mishnah is it pointing to? Because Tosfos in the end says that the subdivision of the profits in the partnership are determined by their pro rata claims or investments. Whereas the Reisha says that it's a case where they divided it evenly between them and not on based on their pro rata share. Although the Rabbeinu Hananel points out that this references the last case in the Mishnah, where they did divide it by pro rata share, and therefore the Chein Hetilu L'Kis would also be based on a pro rata share. Right now, in explaining that, the Gemara now comes up and asks a question. Basically the question that we pointed out, which is that the logic in the Mishnah seems inconsistent until you get to that point where you have the Gemara and Baba Metzia, the logic in the Mishnah seems to be inexplainable. Without understanding the Mishnah and Baba Metzia, each piece of the methodology in the Mishnah seems to be a different logic that's being applied and inconsistent. But then the Gemara now enters with even a different assumption, which is that none of the methods in the Mishnah are the right method, but rather the method that they are used to, and the one that's logical to them, is the one that the Raivud discussed, which is the method of Shibud, which means that you are a party to the division up to the level of your claim. So for the woman who's 100, up to 100, she's in there making a claim with the other women. She gets 33 and a third, and the other women get 33 and a third. By the second 100, the first woman's out of the picture, and only the remaining two women are contesting that amount. And since they are contesting that amount, they get 50 each, but the first woman is not even in that 100. And in the last 100, we have 100 that belongs to the woman who has the 300 because her shibud reaches to that level, her claim reaches that level. Woman number 2 and number 1 aren't relevant to that 100. The second 100, they split 50-50. And the first 100, they split evenly. So that's the methodology that the Gemara uses. And based on that, the Gemara starts to question our Mishnah. Where it says, Shomaneh, notelet, chamishin. In the middle case of the Mishnah, the woman who has 100 gets 50. Tlatin, vitalata, vitiltahu deitla. But she really should only be getting 33 and a third. What the Gemara says is, I don't understand. In the second case and in the third case, the woman number 1, who has a claim for 100, is getting paid out 50. Why is she getting paid out 50? She really deserves 33 and a third. Where are they getting that 33 and a third from? The methodology that uses the level of the claim to determine when you have a right of division. So there, Gemara is saying she deserves 33 and a third. Where are you coming up with 50 in the latter two cases of the Mishnah? So Amar Shmuel. So now the Gemara comes up with a kimtot to take the concept that they used, which is this concept of you get to divide evenly up to the point of your claim. Beyond that, you have no claim. Then that methodology yields different numbers than the Mishnah. And as Professor Elman suggests, that was the methodology that was in use in Bavel at the time. And even from before that, from the time of the Tanaim, as we'll see, that was the methodology in use for hundreds of years. So they try to apply it to the Mishnah, and they don't get answers that are similar to that methodology. So what do? They come up with ukimtot, with explanations of the Mishnah that are far-fetched, but basically yield the answer that they were expecting. So now, Amar Shmuel, Bikotevet Balat Matayim, the Balat Maneh. The woman who has the 200 claim says to the woman who has 100 claim, Dinu Dvarim Imli Imach Bimaneh. I have no contest with you with regards to the first 100. So then the Gemara says, well, if you use that methodology, you're going to run into a problem in a second. But let's use that methodology for a second. When it comes to the first 100, woman number 2, who has the 200 claim, basically cedes her rights to woman number 1 and says, I won't make any claim against you. That means that woman number 1 and number 3 are equally fighting over the first 100. They will subdivide it 50 each. They will each get 50 in that case. Woman number 1 has got 50. That is the Mishnah, that is the case. Mar says, Iochi Ema Seifa. Wait a minute, what about the latter case? Shomatayim. Vishal Shlosh Miot. Shalosh, Shalosh, Shalzahav. The middle case then doesn't work out in that logic. The middle case says that when I only have 200, the latter two parties get 75 each. Why are they getting 75 each? According to this methodology, in the first 100, woman number 1 and number 3 split it evenly. That's 50 each. So woman number 1 gets 50. That is, in the second case of the Mishnah, that is the case. But then, when you move to the second 100, woman number 2 and 3 are fighting over that evenly. They should each get 50. Woman number 3 has 100, and woman number 2 has 50. So the answer that you would get in the second case of the Mishnah would be 50, 50, and 100 based on this methodology. But that's not what happens. The Mishnah says you get 50, 75, 75. So the Gemara says, Teimela, Hasalak Nafshech Mina. You relinquished your position here. And therefore, if you relinquished your position, how come you're ending up with 75 and I'm ending up with 75? Mishum Damrala, Midinu Dvarim Hu, Dislike Nafshai. No, that's not what I said. I released my contestation with the first woman. But I didn't release my contestation with you. So that basically what she says is that I have a right to the 50 that you get in the first case. I have a right to 25 of that. And since I have a right to 25 of that, because I'm contesting you on that 50, then we both end up with 75. Because the second 100 we're going to split evenly. The first 100 is split between woman number 1 who gets 50 and woman number 3 who gets 50. But then she says, I'm still contesting you on that 50. Now, this is somewhat of a difficult explanation of the Mishnah because it's not clear why in this type of division she should get 25. In the first 100, why should she be deserving of anything? And if she is deserving anything, then the way it should divide is that the person who ceded her rights should grant the first woman 33 and a third. If she cedes her rights to that woman, she gets 66 and two thirds. The other woman should get 33 and a third. So this is a little bit of a difficult ukimta that Gemara is trying to establish in order to have the Mishnah match what they think is the way to divide things, which is the methodology of using the level of the claims to cap out your ability to divide evenly within the pot. And so therefore they introduce this seemingly difficult logic, which is that I didn't give or cede my rights to the other woman, Bimatana, and as a gift. And therefore you are a beneficiary of that. The only party that's a beneficiary of my ceding my rights is woman number 1. But with woman number 2, I'm still contesting your rights over here. And therefore, the subdivision here is woman number 1 gets 33 and a third. Woman number 3 gets 33 and a third. Woman number 2, who's 33 and a third, is still there. She says, I cede my contestation with the first woman, which is basically half of my 33 and a third. I give that to her. That's 16 and two thirds goes to woman number 1. And therefore, she gets 50. My other 16 and two-thirds, that I still contest with you, including, and your 33 and a third. So therefore, if I add my 16 and two-thirds to your 33 and a third, I end up with 50, and I'm fighting you over that 50. And that 50 we're going to divide evenly, which is 25 and 25. And that's how we get the result of 75 and 75. Again, it's a difficult type of ukimta to set up in the Mishnah, but because the Gemara has a way that they want to divide it, they're now trying to superimpose that on the Mishnah. So now we move on to the next case. Ayusham Shloshmiot. There's 300 there. Shomatayim gets Maneh. Shivim v'chamishahu d'idla. The 200 gets, in this case, gets 100 according to the Mishnah. But according to the logic of the Gemara, she should only get 75. Like in the second case, she gets 75. In the third case, she should also get 75 because her claim on the last 300 doesn't have any bearing, according to the Gemara's explanation. So based on that, she should get the 75 that she got in the second case and no more in the third case. So Amar Shmuel, so Shmuel comes up with an ukimta again here, which is Bikotevet Balat Shloshmiot, the Balat Matayim. The woman who has the claim of 300 writes to the woman of 200, Ula Balat Maneh, and to the one who has a claim of 100, Dvim Dinu Dvar Mainli Machem Bimaneh. I don't have any issue with you guys in the first 100. So basically, from number 3, cedes her rights to the first 100. So that means in the first 100, there's only a division between woman number 1, who gets 50, and woman number 2, who gets 50. When we move to the second 100, over there, woman number 1 is no longer contesting because it's over 100. So woman number 2 and woman number 3 are going to contest then and split it evenly, 50-50. So 50 of that goes to woman number 2. That gives her a total of 100. The other 50 belongs to woman number 3, plus the third 100, which is all hers because it's above the level of the claimants, the other claimants. And therefore, she gets 150. Now you just explained the last case in the Mishnah. Same methodology according to the Gemara, but a different ukimta. The Gemara's methodology is always the same, which is the methodology that's introduced by the Raivud later on in the Gemara, but a methodology that uses division based up to the level of your claim. You're entitled to split evenly with all the parties up to the level of your claim. So if your claim's 100, you're allowed to split evenly up to 100. If your claim's 200, you're allowed to split evenly with the parties up to 200. Again, your claim's 300, there's nobody contesting you for the last 100. Based on that, the Gemara would have come out with a different answer in case number 2 and case number 3 of the Mishnah. So the Gemara now is caught. How come the Mishnah doesn't have the same answer we do? The Gemara comes up with ukimtot to make the Mishnah conform to that method of division. It says it is that method of division, but with these extra pieces on top of it. We're using that method, but in each case, someone cedes their right to another party. And in ceding their right to the other party, you get the division of the Mishnah. It's a very complex way to come to the answer of the Mishnah, but it's using the logic or through the prism of the Gemara's logical division, they're trying to impose that on the Mishnah. Rav Yaakov Minar Pokit, Mishmei de Rabin Amar, Reisha B'shtei Tfisot, Beseifa B'shtei Tfisot. So now we come up with a different ukimta to try to solve this problem, which is that Ravine over here suggests that the problem here is that the monies that came into the estate didn't come in at the same time. They came in at different rates. It wasn't like they got to the estate and all of a sudden there was 100. They got to the estate, there was 200. They got to the estate, it was 300. But rather, there was a case where two sums of money came into the estate. There were outstanding loans that the husband had had, and now the debtors are paying back that money, but they pay it back at different rates. So at one point, we see the totality of the estate being a certain level. Then all of a sudden, more assets come to the estate after that point in time. And that's basically a suggestion, which is Reisha B'shtei Tfisot. The case of the Reisha is a case that Naflu Shivim V'chamisha B'chad Zimna. 75 came in at once. Now within that 75, all the parties there have equal rights to that, and that will get split up by 25, 25, and 25. Then, all of a sudden, the second time comes down, Meya Vesrim V'chamisha. There's 125 falls the second time to make the totality of 200. That is in the second case of the Mishnah. So now, in terms of the first 75, again, we said it splits evenly because all their claims exceed that amount. But then with another 125, the first woman already took 25 of her amount out. And therefore, she's now coming to fight about the other 75 that she has. So now, what she has left in terms of a claim is 75. If she has a claim of 75, the maximum that she can get out of any division at this point is 75. She can't exceed that amount. She can't divide evenly beyond the 75 amount. So now, when we come to the second 125, she has a claim up to the 75. So that claim up to 75, we're going to divide evenly between the women. That means each one of them will get 25 more. So in getting 25 more, the first woman gets 50. The second and third women also have 50 here, but then we have a residual left. The residual left is, after we've subdivided 150 out of the estate, there's only 50 left. That 50 left is going to be divided evenly between woman number 2 and woman number 3 because their claims exceed the amount here. Since their claims exceed the amount over here, each one of them will be entitled to their 50%, 25, and that means that woman number 1 will get 50. Woman number 2 and number 3 will get 75 each. Then in the next case, the Seifa B'shtei Tfisot. Case number 3 is also in a case where you had two amounts that fell. The Naflu Shivim V'chamisha B'chad Zimna. 75 fell in one shot, and then umatayim ve'esrim v'chamisha b'chad zimna, and then 225 in the next lot. That gets you the total of 300. So once again, in the first 75, all the women divide evenly because all their claims reach that level. So that's 25 each. In the next 225, for the first 75 of that, everybody still has a claim in there. Woman number one still has a claim up to 75. She got paid out 25, so her claim that remains is a 75 claim. So up to the next 75, they're going to divide it evenly again. You do that, each woman has 50 at this point. You've distributed 150 of the assets, and each woman has a 50-50 piece of it. Remaining is 150 and two women. So in the second level of claim, woman number two only had a residual claim of 175 because she already got paid out 25. So the maximum amount that she can claim in this second round is 175. The total is 225 that's going to be distributed. Since that's the maximum amount that she can get, the last 50 is automatically going to belong to woman number three. So the only contested amounts there are the first 75, which are contested by all three women, the second 100, which are contested by woman number two and number three, and the final 50, which all belongs to woman number three. So based on that, woman number got 50, woman number two got 100, woman number three got 100, plus the last 50, which will give her the totality of 150. And therefore, you get the distribution in the last case in the Mishnah as 50, 100, and 150. And that's how they'll explain the Mishnah. So that's the Gemara again, using the same methodology of division, trying to come up with ukimto to make the Mishnah conform to that methodology. But then, here we have the magic piece that tells us this. Tanya, we have a Braita. Zo Mishnat Rabbi Natan. Our Mishnah is authored by Rabbi Natan. Rabbi Omer, Ein Ani Roed Varav Shal Rabbi Natan Ve'ilu. I think that the methodology that Rabbi Natan is using is incorrect, and therefore I do not subscribe to Rabbi Natan's position. Ela, Chokot Bishaveh. They divide it evenly. What does that mean that they divide it evenly? That is subject to Machloket Rishonim. You can already see that in Tosafot. Tosafot says, what is Chokot Bishaveh? Perish Rabbeinu Chananel. Kaimalon Baha Hilchotok Rabbi. That the Locha is like Rabbi. V'yev Shalamit Dvarab. Zman Sheisham Shlosh Meot Chokot Bishaveh. How could it be that when there's 300, that they're all dividing it up evenly? Balat Meya Meya. Balat Matayim Meya. Balat Shlosh Meot Meya. According to the Rabbeinu Chananel's simple reading of this, that means that every party here gets 100. When there's 300, every party gets 100. 100, 100, 100. Literally, chokot bishaveh. They divide it up evenly. Tosafot rejects that and says that cannot be the meaning of chokot bishaveh, because he says that is not an equitable type of division. Going to get paid out much faster than the other amendment. The truth is, it is a methodology. It could be equitable. It doesn't mean that it's inequitable, it's just not the logic that he saw. And therefore, Tosafot says that they get it based on their pro rata claims. So that's what I mentioned, another methodology. Tosafot says they get it based on their pro rata claims, and therefore each one of them will get the pool divided into sixths. Woman number one will get a sixth, woman number two, 2/6 or a third, and woman number three, 3/6 or 50% of it. And therefore, according to Tosafot, in the case of the 300, where you're subdividing it, woman number one will get a sixth, which is 50. Woman number two will get 100. And woman number three will get 150 because you do it pro rata based on their claims. That is another answer of Chokot Bishaveh. The Raivad brings the last methodology. What is Chokot Bishaveh? Is this what's called the Shibud method, which is that you're allowed to collect up to your level of claim. You have rights in the pot. So up to the level of your claim, you have rights to subdivide the pot. Beyond the level of your claim, you have no rights to be in the division of the assets that are there. That is the methodology that the Gemara was using. And seemingly, that is the methodology that Rabbi had. The Raiva then has to answer the question, what's the difference then between what Rabbi is saying and, according to the Gemara, what the Mishnah was saying? Because according to both of them, they're using this method of Shibud. So the answer is, the difference between them is whether you make ukimtot in the Mishnah and try to force the Mishnah to conform to this method of division, or do you say that the Mishnah is using a different methodology, and I just don't subscribe to that? It's using Rabbi Natan's method, which is the method from the Mishnah in Bava Metzia, which gives you consistent answers in the Mishnah. Rabbi says, I understand what Rabbi Natan's doing. I don't subscribe to it. I believe in the methodology that divides by Shibud. Based on their claims, up to the level of claims, they're allowed to contest. So now, the Gemara gives the same answer as Rabbi, or this final stage of the Gemara, but the difference being that the Gemara thinks that they have to superimpose that into the Mishnah. And therefore, they have to come up with these impositions on the Mishnah to make it conform. The last scenario says, no, the Mishnah is not using that methodology. Forget about that methodology with regards to Mishnah, that's Rabbi Natan. And Rabbi Natan uses the method or the logic that is found in the Mishnah in Baba Metziah. Rabbi says, I use this other methodology, the Chokot B'Shaveh methodology. Again, Tosafot comes up with two different ways to say Chokot B'Shaveh, but according to the Raivad, it makes the most sense, which is that the Raivad, it says Chokot B'Shaveh is this Shibud methodology that the Gemara was using all along, because that was within practice. That's what they knew, that's what they saw, and therefore that's why they're trying to reimpose it into the Mishnah, because that's the only method they knew of division. And similar to what we find in the Gemara and Erevin and Sukkah, in other places where there are mathematical formulas or theorems, that many times a lot of the confusion in the Gemara is the misapplication of that theory or taking two different theories and trying to compare them. And that's exactly what happened here. They are taking a method or logic of distribution and then trying to superimpose that on the Mishnah. And based on that, we can explain this Gemara as well as the Mishnah and why there were differences or difficulties in understanding the Mishnah, because they're trying to apply two different methods of division or logic to the same variables. The Mishnah comes up with one answer, and the Gemara comes up with a different answer. So in order to reconcile, the Gemara says, we'll have to say this about the Mishnah, say this about the Mishnah, in order to reconcile them. Rabbi comes along and says, wait a minute, that's just not the case. The Mishnah is using one logic, we use a different logic. So yes, the Mishnah internally is consistent to its logic. We just happen not to hold like that logic. We use a different methodology. That methodology is the way that we're going to paskin halacha, which is based on the methodology of chokot b'shaveh. Now again, the Mishonim argue about what this chokot b'shaveh is. The Raivad is not brought down the halacha, even though seemingly that would be the best explanation of way the Gemara moves, but rather the halacha is the methodology that is proposed by Tosafot, which is literally chokot b'shaveh. They divide it up even the way that it is brought down, lo halacha. That is the explanation of this Gemara. Right. So he discusses that. He said he was mistafina, that he was embarrassed about the fact that how could it be that after 2,000 years that nobody else figured this out? Now he says that it wasn't so complex. Rabbi Natan, who's the author of our Mishnah, had this methodology. The problem was that the practice, the same way we had a problem. Why didn't we figure out this Mishnah? We understand math. We can do this. Once you explain it, you can figure it out. Is because in our mind, there was a methodology for division, which is the way that we would logically divide it. We would do it on the pro rata basis. And based on that, when we do it on the pro rata basis, you don't see the methodology. And the other methodologies, even though when you read in the Mishnah in Baba Metziah, it's obvious when you read it there, to try to apply it over here is less obvious. And therefore, nobody did that. And since nobody did it, they weren't able to get to the answer. The actual information is not so crazy, but to apply it, to think through it, is much more difficult. It's just not obvious to us because we think in a different way. All right, now, Amar Shmuel. Shnaim she'itilu l'kis. Two people who create a partnership for business. Zemanet v'zematayim. Each one of them contributed different amounts. One contributed 100, one contributed 200. Haskar li'emtso. All the profits are divided equally. 50%, 50%. So Amar Rabbo. Rabbo says, wait a minute. Why does that make sense? One party put in 100, one party put in 200. According to modern law, then if there was no partnership agreement that explained the way to divide the profits, then we would subdivide it based on the pro rata claims here. We'd assume that party number one who put in the 100 would get a third of the profits, and party number two put in the 200 would get two-thirds of the profits. Yet, Shmuel is suggesting over here that they divide the profits evenly. So Rabba says, let's qualify Shmuel's statement, at least to make some sense of it. Am Rabba, mistavra milti de Shmuel, b'shor the charisha, v'omei the charisha. Shmuel's makes sense where they bought a shor together as a partnership to plow, and then they rent it out to plow, and they're making rental profits on the shor plowing. Aval, b'shor the charisha, if they bought the shor for plowing, v'omei the tficha, and now they're going to shecht it and take out the basar, each one of them is going to extract the amount that they invested in the animal. Okay, so now, if you look in the Tosafot read, He gives a basic logic. I mean, Rashi and Tosafot also explain the logic, but the Tosafot read gives the logic here, which is, when it comes to profits, the profits are going to be divided evenly, even though they invested different amounts here. One reason Rashi says is because, even though we have uneven ownership in the shore, each one of us has a veto right in the shore. Without my 100, the shore can't be rented out. Without your 200, also the shore can't be rented out. Because of that, we both have what we call equal rights in terms of our ability to allow the shore to go and plow, because neither one of us by ourselves could do it. Only jointly can we do it. And therefore, we believe that they split the profits evenly. On the other hand, when it comes to the principal is got to do with the amount that they invested. Yes. That's not a profit that is on top of the principal amounts invested, but or a product of the principal amount. It's rather the principal itself being redivided. When you subdivide the principal, you got to divide it based on the invested assets. So therefore, the logic here is, when we divide the principal, when it's l'tvicha, we divide it up based on our investment. When we divide up profits, which are not the division of the principal, but in excess of the principal, there we will be 50-50 partners in this case. Now, the Tosafot read gives even more logic this, and you have this in modern day, which is that you can have passive partners and active partners. The active partner is the businessman. The passive partner is investing the cash. So even though they might have uneven investments here, you might still divide the profits evenly, because one party is contributing intangible side to this, which is they are the business, they are the investor. And so therefore, they may be entitled to the profits, 50% of the profits, even though they've only invested 100. When it comes to subdivision of the principal, everybody will agree it has to do with the assets you put in, nothing to do with the profits. But when it comes to profits, you could understand why you would subdivide it differently. Or because you like this guy. Now, liking this guy maybe not be the answer, but family. You might grant a child or a parent more value in the profits than their investment is in the vehicle, because you want to give them something. You're trying to give them income. You want to help them out. So there are reasons to believe that you would split the schar, the profits, evenly, even though your investment in the principal is uneven. So that's what the Tosafot Ri tries to do, is explain that. So now, he points out that not only when you buy it for Harisha in the beginning, even if you bought it for Tvicha originally, you bought it to fatten it up and then sell it for its meat, in that case also, where they bought it for Tvicha, they intentionally bought it to shecht it and then use that monies as the profit because they bought it, fattened it up, and then sold it, in that case also, he says, the excess amount that is above their invested amount would be considered to be profit and not subdivision of the keren, of the principal that they put in. It seems like that would be 50-50. Because that the Mishnah says, pichtu v'otiru. Whether it goes up or down, they'll have a 50% contribution in the profit or in the loss. But in the principal, they will subdivide the principal based on their ownership in it. And that's what the Tosafot Ri explains. But then we have Rav Amnuna, Amar afilu shor lecharishah, v'omei detvicha schar leemtza. Even in a case where you bought it to plow, and then they end up shechting it, it's a 50-50 split. Since it was bought to profit from, then everything that's divided after that point in time becomes a 50-50 split. Meitevei, is that really the case? Shnayim sheitilu lekis, two people join into a partnership, zemaneh v'zematayim. One of them puts in 100, one of them puts in 200. Haschar leemtza, the profits go into the middle. My love, what's the case here in the Braita? The shore, the Charisha, must be a case where they got a shore for plowing. Vomei the Tvicha, and they're going to end up splitting it in the end because they're going to shecht it. B'tiyuvta der Rabo, and that is a strong refutation of this position of Rabo, because even in that case, we're saying you split it 50-50. Gemara says, no. B'shor the Charisha, vomei the Charisha. No, the case in the Braita, that's a very simple answer, is a case where they bought it for Charisha and they're going to plow with it. And therefore, they split the profits evenly. And Rabba would agree with that as well. But then, based on that, you would say, if it was a case where the shore was purchased for plowing, and they end up shechting it for its meat, my, what would you say the din is? You would subdivide it based on your investment, based on your principal investment. So then the Gemara says, Adatani Seifa. Well then, look at the Seifa of the Braita that we just quoted. Lakach ze b'shelo, v'ze b'shelo. If each one of them took their monies, v'nitarvu, and then they joined together, Each one of them takes the subdivides the profits based on their investment. So in this case, instead of investing together into a single object, where they jointly bought a shore, over here they both contributed discrete assets, which is that they have a plow that needs two shvarim to pull it. Each one of them contributed a shore. One of them contributed a shore that was stronger and bigger, that was worth 200. And one of them contributed a shore that was smaller, weaker, which was worth 100. So in that case, the Braita says they do not subdivide it evenly, because over there it's clear that each one's discrete object is contributing a different amount. So as opposed to where you have a single object where they're joined together, over there we would say the profits are divided 50-50. Over here, where each one of them is contributing a discrete asset, and each asset is worth something else and contributing something else, we can clearly subdivide the profits to and attribute them to each one's asset. The stronger shore is going to do more work, is going to contribute more here, therefore he deserves more skar. So the Braita says in that case, you would not divide it based on the 50-50 rule, you would divide it based on the principal investment that they made. So the Gemara says, if Rabba is correct, then why to go to that case where you have discrete assets? Make a much finer distinction that even in a case where they jointly invest in the animal, you could still have a case where they divide by the principal amount invested, not the 50-50. That's only true where they purchased the shore to plow and then end up making profits from plowing. But before the charisha, they bought it to plow. In the end, they end up shechting it. You could have said that finer distinction. In that case, they would subdivide the profits based on their principal amounts invested and not on the 50-50 rule. Mar says, Achinami Kamar. That's exactly what the Braita is saying. But mid dvarim amurim, when is the first part of the Braita true? Bishor the charisha v'omei the charisha. That's in a case where you purchased it to plow and the profits came from plowing. Aval bishor the charisha v'omei the tvicha. But in a case where you purchase the shore for plowing and you end up shechting it and subdividing the meat of the animal, that meat will be divided up amongst the principal investors based on the principal amount they invested. Now again, as the Tosafot Reed points out, if they originally bought it for the point of selling it for its meat and the profits will be the amount of meat there, then they would divide that 50-50 because again there, they're not subdividing the animal between them. They are taking the animal, selling it, and then subdividing the principal and the profits. So over there, the profits would be divided 50-50, and then the principal returns to each of the members. So it depends on the intent and the way that you subdivide it. If you're subdividing the asset itself, then that asset will be subdivided based on the principal amounts. If you're subdividing the profits, then the profits are divided 50-50, and the principal amounts return. So then, what the Gemara says is, in this case where the second half of the Braita is actually making this finer decision, which is in a case where you bought it for Charisha, end up using it for its Bicha, Naseh Kemi, Shlakach Zeh B'Shelo V'Zeh B'Shelo. It's the equivalent case of when they each give in discrete assets to the partnership. Vini Tarvu, and then they put them together, Zeh Notel Lefi Ma'otav, Zeh Notel Lefi Ma'otav. They get pro rata payouts of the profits based on their principal investment. And the same is true over here. It's not. Our Mishnah says, V'chein shlosha sheitilu l'kis, in a case where the three parties join together into a single pool of money then to invest, pichtu o'otiru, if they depreciated in value, I mean there were losses, o'otiru, there were profits, kach hein chokim, they subdivide the same way in the Mishnah. What is the same way as the Mishnah? My love, pichtu mamash, that when they diminished in value means they literally went down in value, o'tiru mamash. And when they went up, appreciated in value, literally they appreciated in value their profits here. And over there, it says that they subdivide the amounts based on the methodology that our Mishnah gives. The methodology of our Mishnah is clearly not an even distribution of profits between all the principal investors. Shmuel says in that case, each one of them should get a third of the profits because they are three different principal investors. One invested 100, one 200, one 300. Nevertheless, in the profits, they will divide evenly. That's what Shmuel says, despite the difference in their principal investments. Yet our Mishnah does not say that. The Mishnah never entertains the possibility that they will divide the profits evenly. It says you will divide the profits based on the methodologies that's used by the Ketubah. Now, the methodology used by the Ketubah is not even distribution. So this will be a question on Shmuel. from Rav Nachman, Amar Rabba Bar Avuah, Rav Nachman, a Talmud of Shmuel, answers on behalf of Shmuel, lo, that it's not literally that they had profits or losses, literally, but Hotiru, what's the case of Hotiru? Zuzei Chadati, new coins. What ended up happening is they pooled their monies in order to do business. They do business, and they end up at exactly the same amount. They started with 600, and they end up with 600. The only thing that actually happened that benefited them is that they started out with older coins. And remember, in their day, the coins were stored value based on the literal metal content of the coin. So they started out with gold or silver coins, and their value is determined by the silver or gold there. Now, over time, coins wore down. So there was a general question is, how much does a coin wear down before people start say that it's no longer worth the actual metal there because too much metal is missing from it? So older coins, while they're accepted as currency, they are on the edge or verge of being disqualified as a currency because they're losing their metal content. So they started out with these older coins, and through their transacting, they end up with newer coins. So and again, in terms of value, it's the same amount. They started with 600, I know it's 600, but the coins that are there are better coins now. So that's what it means, Hotiru. They benefited in that way. So the Mishnah says they will subdivide it based on their principal investment, not evenly, because over there, they're really dividing up the principal. Happens to be that the principal now has coins that were better coins than they started with, but it's still a subdivision of the principal. Pichtu, what's the case of Pichtu? Istira ditsunita. That's a case where they actually ended up with a coin that was no longer good as going currency. The Gemara here calls it a istira ditsunita, which is a coin that is for medicinal purposes. It's mentioned in the Mishnayot in Shabbat, a coin that they used to place on wounds on the bottom of the foot because the rust from the coin was seen as being medicinally beneficial to the individual. And therefore, its only use now is for medicinal purposes and not for going currency. So again, the loss here is that they started out with these coins that were going currency coins, and they ended up with coins that are so bad that those coins can only use for medicinal purposes. So again, when they subdivide it, they're subdividing principle. It's the same coins there. There's 600 worth of coins there. But the coins now are not the quality of coin that they started with. So that's what it means, Hotiru and Pichtu in the Mishnah, in order to preserve this statement of Shmuel, which is that the Hotiru and the Pichtu is not that the value that they had went up or down. They started with 600, they ended up with 600. But in each case, they started with 600 of poor quality coins and up with better quality coins, or vice versa. That is the gain or losses over there. And again, when you come to divide that up, you're subdividing principal. And when you subdivide principal, it is based on the principal amount invested. You're not dividing profits. And since you're not dividing profits, the statement of Shmuel that we divide the profits evenly is not relevant in the case of our Mishnah. And that's why the Mishnah is not a question on Shmuel. Now, Tosafot does qualify that and says that Shladatke Nishtafu Yachad, that was part of the original agreement, that if they did not profit from or lose from this venture that they entered into, business partnership that they entered in together, then if they just got new coins, they would subdivide the coins based on the principal amount. So he says it's part of the partnership agreement. You could argue based on the Tosafot read that it doesn't have to be a part of the partnership agreement, but that would be the way to divide it because we're dividing not profits, but principal in that case, similar to the case of the Shor L'Charisha that ends up getting divided up L'Tvicha. That in that case where you're dividing it up, the principal, you're subdividing the animal, then it should be divided based on the principal amounts invested and not seen as profit, but rather as a division of principal. All right, now next Mishnah. Misha Nesui Dalid Nashim. Someone who was married to four women, Umeit, and then he passes away. Now, over here, Tosafot discusses why the Mishnah had to use four women, and he shows that if you only had two women or three women, you wouldn't realize the chiddush of the Mishnah, and therefore the Mishnah intentionally uses four women to show you that basically the concept of nishba l'achat, if she takes a shvua to one woman, it suffices for all the other women, which is a principle like ner le'achat ner le'meya. So he calls it the principle of nishbeit le'achat nishbeit le'meya, that if she takes a shvua to one of them, it's good enough for all of them. So that's the basic theme of the Mishnah, and that's why the Mishnah has to use four women, and Tosafot explains why it wouldn't work with two or three women. HaRishona kudemet l'shniyah, u'shniyah l'shlishit, u'shlishit l'rivi'it. In this case, the woman who has the first dated shtar, she has rights first, and her collection goes first. And so on and so forth through the numbers here until the fourth wife, who has the last claim on the estate. Now, v'rishona nishbet l'shnia. The Rishona takes a shvuah to the second woman to say that I didn't withhold any more money than I was entitled to my ketubah. Shnia, the second woman, takes a shvuah to the third woman saying that I didn't withhold money from the estate more than the value of my ketubah. Ushlishit l'revit, and the third woman does that same thing to the fourth woman. V'arivit nifreit shelo b'shvuah. And then the fourth woman gets to take her money out of the estate without any shvuah, because she gets the residual. So the only thing she's entitled to is the residual. And she's not competing with any other interests. Therefore, she doesn't have to take a shvuah. And as Rashi points out here, it must be a case where the yitomim are already gdolim. And since the yitomim are gdolim, the Rabbanan's takana, that a bali para, minichse yitomim, has to take a shvuah, is only applicable by yitomim ktanim. Only applies to yitomim who are minors. But if you're already of age, they don't have to take a shvuah. Benanas in a second will disagree with that position and say she has to take a shvuah because she's taking assets out of the estate. And when you take assets out of the estate, there is a residual person. Those are the yitomim. And those residual individuals, she has to take a shvuah to them in order to ensure that she doesn't take more than she deserves, and whatever is left over then will belong to the estate. And you can see here the basic idea is that even though each one of them is only taking a shvuah to the party after them, that shvuah is equally applicable to the women that are down the line. So woman number one who takes a shvuah to woman number two, that's equally applicable to woman number three and four, because they also want to know that she didn't take more than she deserves. But when she takes the shvuah to woman number two, it suffices for all the other women. We don't require a shvuah to each woman. We require one shvuah, which will be equally applicable to all the women. Just because she's the last claimant on the estate, she benefits with taking without a shvuah. She too also will not be able to collect on the estate without taking a shvuah. And again, Rashi explains the machlok between the Tanakama and Benanas as being a case where the yitomim are gdolim, whether the takanat chachamim of a bali parah nichsei yitomim has to take a shvuah is only applicable by ktanim, or is also applicable by gidolim. Hayu yotzim kulam biyom echad. If all their shtarot ktubah are dated on the same day, kol ha-kodemet ha-chaverta afilo sha'achat zachta, then the date makes no difference because they all have the same date. Then we look at a finer detail as to the hour in which the ktubah was signed. And if the hours are different, then we will give rights to the woman who has the earliest hour. She will have the first claim on the estate. V'kacha yukotvim b'Yerushalayim sha'ot. That's what they used to do in Yerushalayim. Not only did they date the shtar, they also put the hour of the shtar in it to know on that day who has the first right of lien, who has the first right of collection on the estate. Hayu kulan yotzot b'shachat. What happens if they have the same date and same hour? Vein sham el amaneh, and there's only 100 there. Chukot b'shaveh. They divide it up evenly, which sounds like the position of Rabbi that we saw before in the Braita that we brought in the Gemara. Although truthfully, it could also be Rabbi Natan, or any of the other logics that we use, because here we don't know the size of the claims. And if we knew the size of the claims exceeded, even the smallest claim exceeded the assets in the estate, then even Rabbi Natan and the methodology of Shibud, all of those methodologies result in the same thing, which is Chokot B'Shaveh, that all the women divide evenly the amount of the assets in the estate. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Gemara at the bottom of Tzadik Gimel Amud Bet.